Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
It's been really good getting to meet you here before the talk, and I'm looking forward to talking to you tonight about the Bill of Rights and Thomistic thought and some ways in which Thomas's reflection on law and America's practice with a written constitution might come together, might connect a little bit. So I'll say a few things here about Thomas just at the beginning, and then I want to give you kind of an in-depth history of the Bill of Rights, not just the Bill of Rights that we normally think of, but just where that whole idea of a Bill of Rights comes from, and then how we got those first 10 amendments. And I think some of what I'm going to say might surprise you a little bit. Maybe it'll even be some good fodder for conversation. But just first here on St. Thomas and law. So Thomas is drawing very heavily from Aristotle. drawing very heavily from Aristotle in his thinking about politics and law. He understands that humans are political animals, that we're social, that we are happy in community, that we need one another, and that human communities come together and they need to have order, and law is an important component of establishing and maintaining that order. What Thomas gives us in the part of the Summa that deals with law, where he talks about eternal law and how God governs everything through his providence, and divine law, right, the part of that eternal law that God has revealed to us, and natural law, that part of the eternal law that we come to know through investigation, through reason, through living in the world, and positive law, right? Our opportunity as human beings to cooperate with God's providence, to be provident ourselves, and to establish laws for our communities that are consistent with the natural law, which of course is part of eternal law. All of that's really, really important, and nobody lays it out as clearly as St. Thomas does. And of course, he's drawing from a tradition. He's not making it up. He isn't the first to discover it. He's drawing, as I said, on Aristotle, but also Cicero, St. Augustine, and many other people. Right? But his articulation of it is so clear. And ever since Thomas lays this out, we've been talking about the natural law, using his terms and his ideas. Americans at the time of the Revolution also talk about the natural law or the law of nature. Right? And it's not always clear whether or not they're thinking in Thomistic terms or they're thinking in Lockean terms. John Locke also has a theory of natural law, and it's different than Thomas's understanding of the law of nature or the natural law. Locke's law of nature is different than Thomas's natural law, which we could get into if you want to later on in the question period. One thing that Thomas doesn't talk about a whole lot is individual rights. He talks about law. He frames everything in terms of law. And it's really, I think, quite important to think about God and creation and the eternal law in terms of law, right? That law has to be consistent with reason, that it's promulgated, right? That it sets limits of some sort on everything, and that God himself, through creation, through spoken word, acts in the fashion of laws, and that when we bring order to our own communities, we do so through the spoken word in the form of laws. So where do rights fit in? Well, later thinkers, both Catholic and Protestant, and then others, talk about rights in ways I think would be very different from the way Thomas would think about rights, if he were to even use those terms. For Thomas, thinking in terms of law, law may provide for groups of people or individuals to enjoy the ability to govern their own lives in some fashion, to be provident over their own household or over themselves. Right? That's an important part of human life, is making choices that lead to virtuous habits and to happiness and to better relationships with our neighbors and to a better relationship with God. So something like a right might be there. We might be able to talk about a liberty or a right, but really Thomas would push us to think about it in terms of law, because when we think about it in terms of law, we're not led into ourselves, we're led into community. Right? We're led into thinking in terms of community. Law makes us think about order and the way our community is ordered. Rights have the effect of leading us to think about ourselves as an aspect or a person or an entity of a group, but not really in our part in the group as a community, right? But what the community owes to me. It leads us into ourselves. It leads us to think of ourselves first and foremost, rather than the common good or the good that we share with those with whom we live. But that doesn't mean that Thomas wouldn't recognize liberty and the importance of liberty. Okay, that's the frame for what I want to say next. I want to turn here sort of abruptly to America, and then we could come back and think about how this might make sense in terms of a Thomistic framework. So I'll be talking about the Bill of Rights. And when I say that phrase, Bill of Rights, what do you think of? Congress shall make no law. The first words of the First Amendment. You probably think of the first 10 amendments, right? Okay, you're all nodding your head. So yeah, when we say the Bill of Rights today, what people think of is the first 10 amendments to the U.S. Constitution. And if you go to Washington, D.C., and you go to the National Archives, you go into the rotunda, and you see the Declaration of Independence, and you see the U.S. Constitution, and then they have a display for the Bill of Rights. And that's all really weird, because those 10 amendments, the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, are just that. They're amendments to the Constitution. They're part of the same document called the Constitution. But somehow we've come to think of it almost like a separate document, almost like we have two constitutions. But what if the Bill of Rights isn't what we think it is? Right? What if we don't really have a Bill of Rights? Right? That's kind of a provocative question. And I don't mean to ask that question in an impertinent way. Right? Many of the clauses that make up the first 10 amendments to the Constitution are among the most popular in the Constitution. The religion clauses of the First Amendment, or speech, freedom of press, also in the First Amendment. Right? These are things that are cherished by many Americans. Many strongly support the right to bear arms, the requirement for searches and for search warrants and other procedural rights are also cherished, right? That these judicial procedures have to be followed very closely. These are all very important. The predominant view that these rights are a Bill of Rights, and that this Bill of Rights was added shortly after the ratification of the Constitution as a separate document, has just become part of our national lore, right? People believe this. And people's beliefs in a republic are important. So questioning the predominant view of the Constitution should be done judiciously, cautiously, in good Thomistic fashion, right? Be cautious when asking these questions. So I do mean to ask this question about whether we really have a Bill of Rights in a very judicious and careful way. But I think it's important to raise it. So I raise the question about the nature of our national Bill of Rights, because I think that most Americans, though they cherish this belief, I think what they believe is a misunderstanding of the reality. Most of us have been taught from a young age that the Bill of Rights enshrines fundamental rights, and we would be foolish to give these things up. And that we're also taught from a young age that it's the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court's intervention that really protects these rights. Playing this role, the court, for over 100 years now, has ruled several laws, mostly at the state level, to be in opposition to some individual right mentioned in the first 10 amendments. And we're told that this greatly contributes to our freedom. It also greatly contributes to the notion that the primary purpose of the Bill of Rights is to specify and protect individual rights, which leads to thinking about our place in society in a very individualistic way. It doesn't push us back into community. What is forgotten by too many people today is that the Constitution does more to empower government than it does to announce fundamental liberties. In fact, the framers of the US Constitution were convinced that the best way to protect the liberties of the people was, paradoxically, by empowering a well-designed system of government. Attaching a Bill of Rights to the frame of the national government was thought by nearly everybody at the Constitutional Convention in 1787 to be unnecessary. Some even thought it was dangerous, and so they didn't do it. They sent to the states a U.S. Constitution that empowers government, and they did not send a Bill of Rights. For many, the lack of a Bill of Rights in the original Constitution was a grave oversight of the framers, but one that was quickly and proficiently fixed by the first Congress under James Madison's prudent guidance. Few know that James Madison had opposed the Bill of Rights originally. He opposed it at the Constitutional Convention, and he only came around to the idea that something like a Bill of Rights might be a good idea when he was faced with the prospect of needing votes from his district in Virginia to win a seat in the U.S. House of Representatives. This was not his only reason for converting to the position that a Bill of Rights should be adopted, or at least something like a Bill of Rights. His friend Thomas Jefferson was eager to see a Bill of Rights added, and he did not hide this opinion from Madison. But most importantly, Madison wanted to steal the only real momentum that the opponents of the Constitution had in the ratification debates. The Anti-Federalists were the ones who pointed out that there wasn't a Bill of Rights. My purpose in this paper and this talk tonight stems from research and I've been doing over the last several years and an argument that I've been building that the set of amendments that we know as the Bill of Rights, those first 10 amendments, is best understood in the context of those early debates over the ratification of the Constitution. James Madison acted quickly in the House of Representatives to save the Constitution from having the type of Bill of Rights championed by the Anti-Federalists and that is widely accepted as true today. Madison took the lead in drafting the amendments in Congress to avoid the calling of a second convention, which likely would have included several provisions designed to weaken the new federal government. But more importantly, Madison took seriously James Wilson's and Alexander Hamilton's arguments that a Bill of Rights was unnecessary and was dangerous to a Republican government. What Madison wanted to prevent was a Bill of Rights that was cherished above the rest of the Constitution. This is because he understood that the Constitution has an educative function for citizens. It teaches them that liberty is protected by appropriately and carefully empowering a government that can control itself, as he says in Federalist 51. Empowering means that the government only has those powers that have been granted to it. If Americans instead learn that the Constitution empowers the people by granting rights, then they will more easily accept the unrepublican view that the government can do what it wills so long as it doesn't violate anyone's constitutional rights. To understand the Anti-Federalist push for a Bill of Rights, as well as the Federalist push back in the ratification debates, we must acknowledge the English tradition that informed the American ratification debates. As one observer correctly remarks, all too few people in this country realize the extent to which our modern liberties are based upon the crucial battles waged against 17th century Stuart tyranny. Indeed, the story of the American Bill of Rights begins with Magna Carta, the Great Charter of Liberties, which was issued by the King of England in 1215 and reissued subsequently with adjustments by later kings. The purpose of the Magna Carta was to appease groups of the nobility who wanted real limitations to be imposed upon the monarch. It also offered protection to other groups, including the church. What is important to note, however, is that the liberties of Magna Carta are offered as gifts of the monarch, who, by the grace of God, is willing to bestow upon the lords, barons, and others certain privileges in the form of monarchical limitations and feudal protections. These limitations and protections were extended more generally to English subjects in later centuries and developed into a tradition of conventional or positive English rights expressed with the greatest clarity in the 1689 Bill of Rights that capped the Glorious Revolution that brought William and Mary to the throne of England. This famous English Bill of Rights was designed as a legislative document, hence the word bill, and was intended to prevent the sort of monarchical abuses that Parliament had seen at the hands of its most recent kings. It protects speech in Parliament and prohibits the raising and keeping of armies in times of peace without Parliament's consent. It also prohibits excessive fines and cruel and unusual punishments, along with guarantees for jury trials. All of these are precursors to the sorts of liberties enjoyed by Americans today under our Constitution, and many of them are right there in the first 10 amendments. The Glorious Revolution was a major source of American colonial ideas about liberty, particularly because colonial assemblies were popular while colonial governors were linked to the British monarch. The monarch appointed the governors. Assertions of legislative rights were already associated with the rights of the people, in large part because colonial charters granted by the monarch allowed for legislative assemblies to represent the people's interests. These charters generally extended all the rights of Englishmen to the English inhabitants of the colonies and often made clear other particular liberties, other positive liberties or positive rights. The Charter of Carolina, for instance, issued in 1663, made clear that any English subject could immigrate freely to Carolina and enjoy, quote, all liberties, franchises, and privileges of this, our kingdom of England. The charter also allows the proprietors of Carolina to use their best judgment when it comes to governing those groups of people who, in good conscience, feel they cannot subscribe to the Church of England, providing at least a slight nod in the direction of religious liberty. But rights were not only to be found in the experience of colonial Americans. They could also read theoretical accounts of natural rights in the work of Enlightenment philosophers such as John Locke, whose many important political writings appeared shortly after the Glorious Revolution. Locke developed the social contract theory that others had put forward before him, but he fine-tuned it, holding that in a state of nature, all people are free, but they are bound by the law of nature, which is known to them through reason and applicable to all equally. Everyone also enjoys on an equal basis the natural rights of property, by which Locke means life, liberty, and estate. The law of nature requires that we respect our own and one another's rights. Violations of rights must be punished, as it is too often necessary and always inconvenient and dangerous to enforce infringements of natural rights, people consent to be governed by a set of institutions of their own choosing with the important proviso that the government itself must respect natural rights. So long as it does so, the people must obey its laws. Locke's influence can be seen in the Americans' response to Parliament's attempt at greater control over the colonies in the 1770s. In the lead up to the American Revolution, after the Stamp Act and the Tea Act, after the Boston Tea Party and the Intolerable Acts, British Americans formed a Continental Congress and sent delegates from each of the 13 colonies to discuss what they understood to be gross violations of their rights. In 1774, that Continental Congress issued a document called the Declaration and Resolves of the First Continental Congress, which accused the British Parliament of abusing both the natural and the conventional, or positive, rights of Englishmen. They appealed to the monarch to defend their rights. First among these rights were the natural rights of life, liberty, and property, the natural rights. The document then goes on to list several other rights, all of which are particular to English subjects and to the colonists of the New World. What's remarkable about this and other documents about the Intolerable Acts, for many of those leading the resistance, is the care that is taken to distinguish between natural and conventional rights. Rights that are universal and inalienable are natural. Rights that are particular to a people are conventional or positive, to use Thomistic language. When George III, the king, refused to stand up to Parliament in defense of British Americans' appeal, a second Continental Congress was formed that voted for independence and famously defended its decision with the Declaration of Independence. They claimed the king had violated Americans' natural rights. Conventional rights tied to the British tradition were hardly mentioned, really not mentioned at all, in the Declaration of Independence. Instead, the focus was on the duty of government to protect the life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness of the people. Since the king was not protecting these natural rights, the colonies could now call themselves states and provide for themselves governments that would protect their rights, their liberties, their natural rights and liberties. Accordingly, the new states, and most of them did this right away, drew up for themselves new state constitutions to replace their colonial charters. Several of these constitutions begin with reminders of the theoretical basis for rights. Americans called these preambles to their state constitutions bills of rights. According to a political scientist named Gary Glenn, these bills of rights that appeared at the beginning of state constitutions were understood to be community-defining declarations that provided a public statement about the nature of liberty and some of the rights that citizens expected to enjoy. I came across another term the other day that I think fits even better. These bills of rights at the beginning of state constitutions were like the bonds of brotherhood, right? These are the principles that unite us as a people. In this way, the state bills of rights provided a high-level civic education to the people. Before reading their frame of government, they begin with a clear statement of purpose of government. Generally, these state bills of rights combined, without any distinction, natural and positive rights. They often begin with statements that drew heavily from Lockean theory and asserted a right to revolution. These statements resemble closely the language of the Declaration of Independence. But unlike the Declaration of Independence, they included references to several conventional positive rights, such as the freedom of speech in the press, the right to assembly, due process of law, trial by jury. Some rights came from the experience of the American Revolution, such as prohibitions on quartering of troops and the right to bear arms. The first and most important of these state declarations of rights came from Virginia, and it's actually concurrent to, slightly prior to, in fact, the Declaration of Independence. And you, since you all go to school in Virginia, I'm sure you know that the author of the Virginia Bill of Rights is?
Jefferson.
Not Jefferson, George Mason. George Mason's the author of the Virginia Declaration of Rights. George Mason is at least given credit for drafting that Declaration of Rights. And he intended it for, to be a theoretical statement of liberties attached to the Virginia frame of government as a precursor, as a preamble. Its first article reads like this. Let's read part of it to you. It says that all men are by nature equally free and independent and have certain inherent rights of which, when they enter into a state of society, they cannot by any compact deprive or divest their posterity, namely the enjoyment of life and liberty with the means of acquiring and possessing property and pursuing and obtaining happiness and safety. In addition to this statement, the Virginia Declaration of Rights makes clear that all power is derived from the people, that the people therefore have an, again quoting it, an indubitable, unalienable, and indefeasible right to alter or abolish governments that fail in providing for the common benefit, protection, and security of the people, nation, or community. The document goes on to say that elections are to be free, executives are to be controlled by the legislature, trials ought to be by jury, no excessive bail or cruel and unusual punishments should be allowed, search warrants are mandatory, freedom of the press is to be protected as one of the greatest bulwarks of liberty, militias, rather than standing armies, are to be the means of protecting the nation, and finally, the people of Virginia are called upon to maintain virtue, and religion is to be free of force and violence. Other states followed Virginia's lead in crafting their own state constitutions, usually with a Bill of Rights at the beginning or with some opening statement about individual liberty. Pennsylvania, Delaware, Maryland, and North Carolina all promulgated new state constitutions in 1776, right, the year of the Declaration, and all followed Virginia's lead in appending a Bill of Rights to the document at the beginning. New Jersey, Georgia, and New York ratified new state constitutions without a Bill of Rights. But all of those state constitutions have preambles that embrace popular sovereignty and the right to revolution. Following then the example of Virginia, and no doubt inspired by the eloquence of the Declaration of Independence, the states combined the work of defining rights and framing government. The relationship between these two activities was less clear in those states that had bills of rights. How exactly were the rights to be protected? Right, when they show up in a preamble, it's not clear how you protect them necessarily. The discussion of rights in the context of the frame of government provided some clarity to this question. So state constitutions that would insert rights within the frame, would that made clear how those rights would be protected. But even in those states that did incorporate rights in its frame, the overwhelming thrust of the preambles of all the state constitutions during the Revolutionary War period is an elevation of individual liberty as the paramount purpose of civil government on the one hand, and the confounding of the distinction between natural and conventional rights on the other. More care is given to telling governments to protect important rights than in framing governments to do so. And just as an interlude here, I think that this period of constitution making in America's history, immediately after 1776, during and immediately after, was in many respects stepping away or moving away from a Thomistic understanding of government and liberty. Because the states initially had the responsibility of providing government for the people, protection of rights was seen as paramount at the state level. Thus, no one blinked an eye at the absence of a Bill of Rights under the Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union, which is the full title, the Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union. When the Congress under the Articles passed the Northwest Ordinance, they were quick to make plain that the inhabitants of that territory would enjoy basic American rights until the establishment of state governments. But while Congress was busy passing this ordinance, the entire enterprise of a firm league of friendship under the Articles of Confederation was falling apart. A constitutional convention was taking place in Philadelphia, right next door to Congress, in fact. And unknown to anybody outside of its walls, that convention was debating a constitution that would act upon the people of the United States, making it a government proper and not just a treaty organization. The Articles of Confederation was basically just a treaty organization, just a firm league of friendship among the states, not really a government. Near the end of that convention, one of the holdouts to the plan, somebody who was threatening not to sign the document, was a guy from Virginia named George Mason. One of the reasons, in fact, the principal reason he gave for not wanting to sign the document was that it lacked a Bill of Rights at the beginning. He likely had in mind a preamble, much like the states had at the time. He reasoned that a Bill of Rights would be expected of a government and that the people will be disquieted, upset, without a statement in defense of their liberty. But Mason's proposal gained no traction. Some people speculate that the delegates were tired after more than 4 months of discussions in the hot Philadelphia summer, and that they just wanted to go home. But Mason pointed out to them that they could take care of a Bill of Rights right then and there. It wouldn't take any time at all. He suggested they just use his own Bill of Rights from the Virginia Constitution. We could just adopt that. The delegates weren't interested, probably because they didn't think it was necessary. It's hard to tell because, at least in Madison's notes, there's no debate recorded. In fact, it doesn't even look like they voted on it. They did, however, follow the example of states like New Jersey, Georgia, and New York by including several clauses interspersed throughout the document's text that referred to the sorts of things that might be found in a Bill of Rights, such as a prohibition on the suspension of habeas corpus, as well as prohibitions on titles of nobility, ex post facto laws, and bills of attainder. There was also a prohibition on religious tests for holding office. These kinds of things were often included in state bills of rights, but the framers of the Constitution made the decision to integrate them into the document rather than provide a Lockean preamble that mirrored the Declaration of Independence. Instead, they provided a simple, elegant one statement or one sentence statement of what the Constitution was designed to do, rather than beginning with what it could not do. It was designed, said the preamble, to provide a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and to our posterity. Each of those parts of the preamble point to community rather than to the individual. None of these six ends or goals or purposes of the Constitution were seen as being at odds with any of the others. They were a package deal. They go together. And they are achieved not by the constant threat of popular revolutions, but paradoxically, by empowering government and designing its institutions in such a way that abuses of power can be checked. To their minds, this was an improvement over the approach of the state governments, which had proven to be more serious in talking about liberty than in actually protecting it. The Constitutional Convention thus handed over to the states for ratification an improved type of written constitution that its defenders were certain was better crafted than the state constitutions. But not everybody was convinced that this was so. And a group of people in each of the states arose to question the soundness of replacing the Articles of Confederation with a national government. These anti-federalists, as they were called, probably without real justification, they certainly didn't like being called anti-federalist. They actually believed in a confederacy or a federal government. They arose to challenge this new constitution. They said it was too theoretical, too novel, too powerful, that it would too severely curtail state powers. The anti-federalists held that large republics were impossible, that only at the level of the states could the people adequately be represented. We had just fought a war, they argued, to get rid of a central government that was far away from the people, far away from their interests. Why would we go back to that type of government and that type of situation? Anti-federalists also pointed out that the Constitution, unlike several of the state constitutions, did not contain a Bill of Rights at the beginning. While this was not their most substantive critique, it was the argument that seemed to catch hold of the popular imagination. No Bill of Rights must mean that this new big central government would in time invade the most basic and cherished rights of the people. Don't we need some statement that when governments get despotic, the people have a right to rebel? Right? Given the power of this view on the popular imagination, anti-federalists seized upon it and used it as cover to call for a new convention to draft amendments to the Constitution, or maybe a whole new Constitution with greater transparency and greater regard for the liberties of the people. The Federalist pushback against the call for a second convention pointed out that a Bill of Rights was unnecessary in a republic. One of the first public statements against a Bill of Rights for the United States was by James Wilson of Pennsylvania. He made this argument on October 6, 1787, less than a month after the convention finished its business. Wilson argued that there is a distinction between state governments and the new national government. He explains that when the people established the powers of legislation under their separate state governments, they invested their representatives with every right and authority which they did not in explicit terms reserve. The national government took the opposite approach. Their congressional authority is to be controlled not from tacit implication, but from the positive grant expressed in the instrument of union. So for the states, everything that's not reserved is given. But for the federal government, everything which is not given is reserved. This would make the inclusion of a Bill of Rights at the national level superfluous and absurd, he said, because it would stipulate that the national government could not do things that it could not do. What's the point in saying that it cannot do things that it cannot do? The answer, Wilson says, is none. But he also hints that there may be good reasons not to list rights, even for purposes of security, since a declaration of a right might be construed to imply that some degree of power was given that needs to be constrained by the elevation of a right. In other words, it could lead people to believe that the government possesses extremely broad powers that are only bounded by declaration of rights. The hope is that Americans and their representatives will understand that they will be educated to see that something closer to the opposite is true, that the national government's powers are enumerated, and that enumerations both empower the government and broadly protect human liberty. Alexander Hamilton, writing as Publius in Federalist 84, borrows and builds upon Wilson's argument in Federalist 84. He argues that the Constitution is designed to protect liberty and that adding a Bill of Rights to this Constitution would be unnecessary and also dangerous. With the Magna Carta in mind, he argues that the English love of Bills of Rights is essentially monarchical and something Americans who now live in a republic should drop. The English, he says, are justified in their love for the contractual statements of rights because they are privileges that have been given to them by their king. But in America, the people are sovereign. And we, the people, by our grace, allow the government certain privileges and powers. Where we have not given power, the government is limited. A Bill of Rights would give the wrong impression. It would suggest that the government's only limits are those statements of rights listed in the Bill of Rights. The reality, Hamilton says, is that Americans enjoy far more liberties than can ever be listed in a document. It's better to focus on the government's limited powers than to suggest that we have limited rights. Now, Hamilton wrote Federalist 84 before seeing the Bill of Rights that we have today, before seeing the 10 amendments to the Constitution. So I think sometimes when we read Federalist 84, we read back into it the thing that we call the Bill of Rights today. He was therefore thinking about a preliminary statement of rights at the outset of a constitution. And so the real danger that worried him has to do with the sort of civic education that the Constitution provides to the people. Hamilton hoped that the Constitution, while being a frame of government, would also educate Americans on the proper institutional design of government for the promotion of certain ends, including the protection of liberty. A Bill of Rights would compete with the rest of the Constitution in providing this education. It would teach people that governments naturally invade individual liberty, so you should know what your rights are and fight back at the slightest breach of their invasion. But so long as the government is not harming your rights, you have no reason to complain. Right? That's the view Hamilton's hoping Americans don't learn and don't adopt. The substance of Hamilton's arguments against bills of rights, especially that they are unnecessary with less emphasis on their danger, is repeated at the ratifying conventions in Pennsylvania, Virginia, New York, Massachusetts, and elsewhere. Many anti-federalists, especially here in Virginia, whose Bill of Rights at the beginning of its state constitution was the most well-known, were unconvinced by these arguments. Moderates in the states began striking a bargain. They would vote for ratification, but also propose amendments to the document, particularly amendments that would amount to a Bill of Rights. And this is just what several of the states did. The Constitution was thus ratified, but many Americans were unsatisfied with the document, fearing that it would not adequately protect their liberty. Once the Constitution went into effect, after it was ratified, action had to be taken. Members of Congress needed to be elected, the president needed to be selected, judges for courts needed to be chosen, etc. States had to draw up electoral districts for the House of Representatives, and they had to choose senators. Of crucial importance is the fact that the legislature of Virginia was composed of people who were anti-federalists, who were unhappy with the new U.S. Constitution. And so they chose two senators to represent the state who had voted against ratification. This was bad news for James Madison, who had wanted to serve in the Senate. He was forced to turn his hopes to the House of Representatives, which meant he would have to stand for election. Many of his would-be constituents had been persuaded that the lack of a Bill of Rights was a major defect in the new Constitution. And Madison's reputation as a Federalist was a threat to his election into the system that he had played such an important role in crafting. With urging from Thomas Jefferson, Madison softened his own view of having a Bill of Rights and gave the citizens of his district reason to hope that he would fix the situation if elected. And he was elected. True to his word, Madison urged the House of Representatives to consider amendments to the Constitution that would serve as a Bill of Rights consistent with the designs of the Constitution as a whole. What I think Madison hoped to do was take the lead in crafting something that looked like a Bill of Rights, thus satisfying his constituents, but also stealing from the anti-federalists their primary weapon against the new Constitution. Some anti-federalists were still hopeful that a convention could be called for drawing up a Bill of Rights, and Madison knew better than anyone else that once you call a convention, all bets are off, right? Anything can happen. He suspected with good reason that a new convention would do far more than draft amendments or a Bill of Rights. So rather than leaving it to a future convention, he proposed that the House of Representatives take the lead. His speech of June 8, 1789, provides a robust defense for a Bill of Rights for the new federal government, while acknowledging as important those concerns voiced by Wilson and Hamilton. He thus proposed that the amendments be made throughout the document rather than writing a theoretical statement at the beginning. This would have the effect of maintaining the present form of the Constitution, which plainly outlines the design of our political institutions with enumerated powers that are limited. If I understand Madison correctly, he really is sensitive to Wilson's and Hamilton's arguments that a Bill of Rights could misteach Americans to think of government as monarchical rather than as republican. Madison's proposal to integrate amendments into the text of the Constitution means that the intended design of the document would not have to compete with a statement of purpose at the beginning, a statement of purpose that would likely have a lot to do with individual rights and the right to revolution. Reluctantly, the House agreed to form a committee to review Madison's proposed amendments. But Roger Sherman, a representative from Connecticut who attended the Constitutional Convention and was originally opposed to a Bill of Rights, feared that by inserting clauses throughout the text of the document, it would give the impression to people that the signers of that Constitution agreed to all those new clauses. He didn't want to have that reputation. He thus proposed that the amendments be listed at the end of the document. This proposal was accepted, and the committee, which included Madison, reported to the House 17 proposed amendments. These amendments then went to the Senate, which reduced them to 12, mostly by redesigning them. After a little tinkering between the two houses, these 12 amendments were approved and sent to the states for ratification. What's noteworthy about these 12 amendments, even though they are not integrated into the document, is that they still follow the general institutional outline of the Constitution. This is seen more easily when you consider the first two amendments, which were not initially ratified. They begin with amendments related to the legislative branch. They then move on to amendments related to the executive branch. They then move on to amendments related to the judiciary, and they end with amendments that are more general, miscellaneous, educative. This means that the amendments taken as a whole serve the educative role that is meant to quiet the Hamiltonian fears and reinforce the idea of republican government in America, namely the idea that in a republic, a well-designed written constitution is what best protects people's liberty, and that this protection works better than listing out the rights that people have. Why does this matter? It matters because if Wilson and Hamilton are right that a Bill of Rights is unnecessary and maybe even dangerous, and that the love of a Bill of Rights is essentially monarchical and anti-republican, then something was needed that would preserve the original intention of the Constitution and still quiet some of the frustrations or doubts people had about it. It matters, too, because the way Americans understand their Constitution makes a big difference, right? Do we think of the Constitution as a document that empowers and thus limits government by setting out its primary objectives and telling it could do no more than this? Or do we think of the Constitution as a document that lists and secures our rights, and that so long as government isn't violating our rights, there's no problem? How we understand the Constitution matters because, in addition to the document framing our government, it also frames us. It also educates us. It shapes us. Hamilton and Madison understood this, which is why Hamilton cautions against the Bill of Rights and why Madison proposes amendments that kind of look like a Bill of Rights, but that are, in fact, quite different from what the Anti-Federalists were really calling for. How we understand the Constitution ultimately shapes the way we understand ourselves as Americans. Do we think of ourselves as free citizens living in a republic, a republican constitutional polity, as members of a community who are in a joint project of protecting the common good, including the goods of liberty, the goods of preserving our lives, our liberties, and the happiness of one another? or do we think of ourselves as being rights-bearing citizens who have the privilege of asserting our interests at the expense of the community and one another? If we think of ourselves the first way, as citizens of a republic living in a constitutional polity, as members of a community in a joint project of protecting and promoting the common good, then I think we're doing something that at least approaches a Thomistic position. If we think of ourselves as right-bearing individuals who have the legal privilege of asserting our interests at the expense of the community, then I think we're not doing anything close to living in a Thomistic polity. Right? We're living in something quite different. I think in general, what the anti-federalists were asking for was what they were enjoying in the States, and that was not very Thomistic. What the Federalists were fighting for, whether they knew it or not, was something at least approaching a more Thomistic position. They gave us something, Madison gave us something, that is more consistent with the Federalist view. Something kind of like a Bill of Rights, but not really a Bill of Rights. Statements of rights that could be inserted into the Constitution without losing the overall framework of the Constitution that helps shape us as Republican citizens in a joint project of community. It only works, though, if we understand it that way. And I don't think we really understand it that way anymore. The fact that most of us think of those first 10 amendments as a Bill of Rights that secure our individual liberties is a testament to the fact that we have slipped back into the anti-federalist view of things, that we have failed to understand what Madison is really up to. And in doing so, we understand our Constitution in a way that's more British, more monarchical, more like the Magna Carta than a Republican Constitution. And I think that might be one reason why we think of the Constitution as affording rights not just to individuals, but also to certain groups, just like the Magna Carta did. It creates a certain type of 21st century identity politics, much like the 13th century identity politics that reigned in England. This is the danger that I think Wilson and Hamilton are pointing out to us, a danger that we have slipped into. All right, have I totally scandalized you all? I hope so. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.